My next guest today has managed to perform at the highest level across a number of diverse and highly competitive disciplines. Former professional rugby player with Leinster, Gaelic football player with Westmeath, to name just some of his sporting achievements. He's an award-winning musician in his own right and also with his own band, The Blizzards. People will know him as a judge and coach on The Voice of Ireland. But away from shining bright on the pitch and stage, it's his own very personal struggle with depression and his battle to overcome it that has really endeared him to just such an audience. And his openness has undoubtedly touched people in a way that we probably can never fully assess. Anyway, he continues to be a mental health advocate, and that's why he joins me today, because his podcast series, Where Is My Mind, will go live on Monday. Niall Bresley, you're very welcome. Which do you prefer, Niall or Bresley?
Absolutely no problem with either of them. I've been called Bresley since I was a kid. It's not a very original nickname. So whatever you want to go with, Marion.
Okay. Okay. Now, you were in the Galway Film Fla on Thursday with the new satirical documentary, which you're calling a mockumentary. Tell us about that.
That was, that came about, the band were making a new album. We were going to make a music video. We're like, oh, this could be, don't want to make a music video. They're just, everyone's making music videos or something. We wanted to do something a little different. And we went away for 4 or 5 years and took a break. And in that time, the music industry changed dramatically. Like, barely recognisable. You
really?
Know, when we moved to Spotify, algorithms, numbers. It became more about that, really, than...
than the music?
Well, maybe not the music, but also it came to the point we were going to, our album's even still relevant anymore. So things had changed, and that's just the nature of creative industries. Things change a lot and they're dynamic. So we had to figure out what do we want to do, and we had this idea, and we wanted to make a kind of a mockumentary about what's happened in the industry and where we stand in it now. And it was just a complete joke that grew into something, and we brought in like brilliant director and writer Jeff Doyle and Crooked Gentleman and a few others, and we just started combining, and it was one of the most enjoyable processes. But like, we screened it in Galway Fla on Thursday, and it was one of the most nerve-wracking feelings I had. I was sitting right at the back of the cinema, so nobody, just in case, and people were laughing, but and they didn't boo, which is
very
a plus for me. So that's, I'm going with that. I'm happy enough with it. They thought it was funny, I think, or else they were just laughing because they were intimidated.
I gather a star-studded cast.
There was a few people in it, all right. We made a few asks, some random asks. So we had Brian Tuberty, as he was called in the documentary,
yeah.
By our absolutely slightly inept manager Duncan. So we had a few people. We had can't name them all off the top of my head.
Amy Huberman.
Amy was in it. Yeah, she was.
Mattress Mick, Shane McGowan, the Happy Pair, Tommy Lee, Snoop Dogg, Stormy Daniels, Louis Walsh. How did the concept arise? It was something to do with a comment on your work, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it was. Actually, funny you say it. Mattress Mick was the one who got the biggest... No, that's a superstar. That was the one. And when he came on the screen, people were like, wow, how did he get Mattress? And the fact we all think his first name is Mattress and then his confirmation name is Mick. But the idea came back. We put out a single. Well, you put out... When you do... whatever, a single, yeah, or an album, it's very nerve-wracking when you put it out and you have to get your feedback either, yeah, from radio or playlisters or Spotify playlisters. And one particular playlist's reply was, it was this simple, it's too guitar-y. And I thought to myself, what does that mean? It's too guitar-y. I mean, there's a guitar in it. Is there something wrong with that? Is there something wrong that we have? And it almost felt like guitars had become illegal. And we kind of said the way to respond to that is either get deflated or you actually do something with that information and, you know, tell a story with it. And that's kind of where this came. And then the song called Who Would Be in a Guitar Band came out of that.
Yeah.
And then a documentary and a mockumentary and a, yeah, film, and all of a sudden we're in a film festival. So it's hilarious.
Send up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
It's nice to do those, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. And it's different. And it's if you work anything creative, you know, creativity is a curse and a joy. It's both. But if you can actually find something and go at it, there's nothing better.
Right. Okay. Now, you said you'd broken up for 5 years. That was all just you were moving on. It wasn't rows and...
No, same thing. We all, real life kicked in. We had to pull up the big boy pants, and
yeah,
people had kids. We had to, you know, make some choices. And
yeah,
that was reality. The industry's a tough place to be to make
a
living.
To do all those, yeah, kind of things. No, let me move you on. When did you get into mindfulness?
Personally, and mindfulness is a word I'm very protective of because it's so broad now and it's so kind of, it's slightly diluted, really, which is why I went back to study it. But personally, I started...
And by the way, congratulations, MA.
Yeah, I'm finished, thank God. I that was something I'm very proud of, I have to say, because I had a lot on to take on a master's as well in that space was difficult. But for me personally, I started engaging with mindfulness about 7 years ago, 6 years ago, practicing it. And I really hated it. I really struggled with it. It was really overwhelming because one of the things that I suppose my panic disorder, one of the biggest manifestations of it was my breath. I had a really bad relationship with my breath. And I always believed that meditation and mindfulness was just concentrating on your breath. But every time I did, I'd get slightly overwhelmed or panicked by it. So I always felt it was a very rough kind of intro into mindfulness. But somebody said something to me, listen, it's been around 2,500 years. There's probably a little bit more to it than just this.
Yeah.
And let's explore it. And then I started exploring the kind of Buddhist roots of it and the Buddhism aspects and the Buddhist psychology of it. And that really opened my mind into a totally different approach to what I actually thought mindfulness was, because I always believed it was about relaxation. And I now know that's literally just a side effect, a potential side effect of it, which led me into realizing I want to get to the crux of this, the neuroscience, the Buddhist philosophies, and that's when I decided I wanted to go back and study it. And I applied for the master's in UCD in School of Psychology.
Right.
Didn't think I would get in at the time, but I did, and it was the best thing I've ever done.
And tell me, I mean, it's always asked of what are called mature students. Hard to go back after a big long break, you know, to studying and focusing and writing, I presume, an awful lot. And, you know, if one has left that behind and you're looking around at these youngsters, does it make it difficult?
I didn't really care. I got 10% off Starbucks, 10% in Topman, 10% in most shops. I had a student card. I got a free gym membership. I was milking that for 2 years.
Okay,
so
yeah.
That was the good stuff. But I actually think my initial kind of run of my degree, I did my degree in UCD as well, wasn't particularly a bright time in my life, and I didn't enjoy it. I found UCD, I found third level, I found I was on a rugby scholarship as well. I wasn't dealing with it well at all. So it was the one part of my life I didn't want to return to. But ironically, when you break down what mindfulness really is, that is what it is. It's returning or coming towards things that might make you uncomfortable and figuring out a way of being with them. Because our human condition is to run from things that make us uncomfortable, whether they're pasts, whether they're future. We don't like experiencing them. But the reality is they're inevitable. These are inevitable parts of being a human, and you have to figure out a way of being with them.
And, you know, I'm conscious that every day in the paper you read of people terrified they're going to lose their homes, terrified of this going wrong, terrified of an illness, worried about a child, etc. Like, there are times when you can't be happy.
No, and I think we have to do two things here when it comes to the kind of dialogue and narrative around this. First, it's really important we start understanding how our minds were built and how they were designed back in the days where we were the basic requirement of human beings from our ancestors' days where we lived in caves was to get our genes into the next generation. And to do that, we had to survive. And the way we had to survive was we had to be overly cautious. We had to be very, very careful. We had the fight or flight, the negativity bias, all these parts of our brain that worked really, really well for survival and for Darwinism. But the reality is those same traits are eating us alive now because we're consuming so much and we feel under constant threat. When you talk about those media headlines, when you talk about that constant exposure to very, very difficult things. So as human beings, what we tend to do is we desensitize ourselves. And that's normal, that's natural. But when we desensitize ourselves, we start losing that empathy, that ability to connect with people and communicate with people. And that's not good. And that's where we're going in terms of where our minds are going. Our minds haven't changed a hell of a lot since those days. So the reality is there's another thing we have to frame here is, and it's important to point this out, in recent years, we've created this kind of cult of positivity. Positivity is really powerful and really important. And if you understand the neuroscience behind it, it's really exciting because when you can show this ability to have gratitude and compassion for yourself, it can change everything. And it's something that changed my life, undoubtedly. But we have to not vilify negativity. Negativity is important. We need to experience it. Life is not a straight line and we shouldn't feel bad. But what we explore in the podcast that I think is really interesting is we have to hold negativity to account because not every negative thought you have is real. but we think it is. So rather, I think there's more power in understanding how to navigate negativity than just to believe you have to be positive all the time. So there is this culture where we're being thrown fridge magnet philosophies everywhere we look, saying, you know, just be positive. If you're going through an acute phase of struggle, it's very, very difficult to do that.
Well, I have to say from time to time, when people say have cancer, and sometimes, well, most people get the fear of God in them when they get a diagnosis, and then, you know, life has moved on and there are very good outcomes, but not in all cases. And yet, there's kind of this thing, oh, she's, you know, she's very positive, she'll fight it. And that means that if it gets you, you've lost.
And that's a framing of language. Language is really powerful. And I think we kind of missed the point. When I talk about positivity, I've built positivity. So our brains are built around habitual behaviour. So a lot of our behaviours are sometimes negative. And we have negative thought processes like, I'm not good enough, or this is going to be awful. And the more you say that, the more the brain builds a habit of doing it. And that works exactly the same for positivity. So if you can find a way to habitually try and be positive, like when you wake up in the morning saying five things that you have in your life that you actually are thankful for. But when you break this down, say, to young people now, break it down to what they're exposed to, and actually to everybody. When you're constantly exposed to perceived perfection online all the time, that takes its toll. And what the podcast really wanted to look at is culture, because we seem to always put the blame on the individual. Like, you've done something wrong. There's something wrong with you. And I wanted to put a bit more kind of aim on culture and environments and our conditioning and how we've been brought up. Yeah. And how these haven't really helped us deal with the really simple parts of being a human. I mean, in 40 years' time, when robots are doing all our jobs, this is the one thing we have over them: the ability to understand emotion. And it's the one thing I'm very passionate about, because once we start understanding and having that self-awareness, we can start becoming a hell of a lot more clear about our internal life and our external life and how it's affecting us. But right now, we're all moving so fast and trying to get somewhere that we're missing living.
Right.
And it's
you made the point about the man and his child in the Rio Grande, or the Rio Grande, and that we seem to have lost empathy. We just look, oh, they died.
But it's not our fault that that's happening. That is normal. We can't. We're being exposed to this at a rate that we've never, ever been exposed to something like this before. Bad things have always happened in this world, but now we're seeing them all the time. Now, let's break this down to something like the negativity bias.
Yeah.
Which is what we were built with when we designed our brains back in the day. And that negativity bias kept us overly cautious and it kept us safe. We'd always believe there was a snake behind a bush, and most of the time there wasn't, but that one time there was, you were ready for it because you had that negativity bias. But now what's happening is we're manipulating that negativity bias, and we're putting out these toxic stories and toxic headlines and out of context stuff, and we're creating this horrible binary society where everyone's just screaming at each other and shouting, and they're not willing to debate or have civil debate. They're willing to shout, and all our really nuanced, sensitive debates are happening online. You can't have nuanced, sensitive debates online about really important social movements that we need to protect. But this negativity bias, if you look at the headlines that we are now consuming, back in the 80s, if you looked at, you went into a news agent, the headlines were generally not too, you know, and magazines, or I remember my mum used to make me go down and buy her Woman's Own. She'd always give me money to buy chocolate if I went and bought her the magazine, and I'd buy it. And watching
that's
how
called bribery.
Listen, yeah. She's my mother. She's allowed.
Yeah, she is.
And I made the story and I started looking at the way headlines look now. And they're not even real. They're not true. They're out of context. Because what's happening is there's a war for our attention, Marion. And our attention has become a really powerful commodity to people who, it's become the oil of the modern world. And now you look at things like apps and stuff. Like, all these app developers are hiring clinical psychologists to make their product addictive. And there's this war for attention. And the issue with that is because the last person that now has their attention is themselves. And then you break that down to personal relationships. If you're sitting at home with your partner and she or he's looking at you, or they're looking at you going, you're not here. You're a million miles from here. And if you don't give someone your presence, it's literally it's the lowest. It's not a nice thing to do to somebody. So when you combine all this, how our brains were designed, how they were built, our conditioning, our environment, our culture, the traumas that we've all experienced, especially Irish people have had a difficult history, and you combine that all, there's no wonder we're all overwhelmed.
Right.
You know, there really is no wonder, and we have to do something. And I'm hoping this podcast brings awareness to that, but also gives people the tools to do it.
Right. What surprised me, because I thought otherwise, that we kind of patted ourselves on the back, that we did funerals well. But you don't, in the sense that, and I could hear it, I'm listening to the podcast, you know, that you say to somebody, how are you? Mm. And they say, I'm grand, I'll be okay. Mm. And somebody else says, how are you bearing up? I'm fine, you know, I'll get there. And then we say, sorry for your troubles. Mm. But I thought we all understood all that.
Yeah, of course we do, because we're really uncomfortable with other people's pain. And we know that. So when somebody goes to a funeral, and they kind of put it in context, the funeral was kind of a metaphor of how we run away from emotion. You know, how we rather than actually going to deal with this, we internalize it, because we still have a social stigma in this country, no matter how we talk about the awareness, which has been brilliant. There is still a social stigma around pain and stress. So, and often, in something like a funeral, you go to a funeral, you say, how are you doing? I'm grand. And I just want to scream, you're not grand. This is torturous. It's the worst pain that you will ever experience. Grief is torturous. And we will all experience in grief. Every person on this planet experiences it. And I wanted to say, like...
But if somebody came up to you and said, I'm sorry for your troubles, or how are you keeping? And you said, I am in a pit of despair, and you had to say that to everybody at the funeral, you'd crawl into the pit.
Absolutely. No, and I, in kind of to put it in, it was kind of used as an example.
Okay.
At a wake, when there's about 300 people coming to shake your hand, you're going to say, just you get out of here. I want to go home. I'm really tired. I get that. I think it's more, I was in context, I'm talking about my friends who've lost people.
Yeah.
And you have that moment with them, and you look them in the eye, and you grab them by the hand, and I said, I hope you're okay. And they go, I'm grand. I'm like, you're not grand. And it's okay that you're not grand. And I'm okay with you not being grand.
Yeah.
And because when you force somebody to internalize that stuff, especially in things like grief, and there's a process to grief, they can often move to things like maladaptive coping, like alcohol, drug abuse, obsessive behavior, excessive exercise, to try and deal with that pain. And what we need to move to as humans is figuring out how can we be with that with people so they don't have to run from it. And how can we support them through it? And at the crux of mental health issues and people who struggle with their mental health, an awful lot of the times is because they've had to run, and they've had to repress, and they've had to pretend it hasn't happened, and they've had to hide and mask it. And that does a lot of damage.
And did you do that from being a youngster?
Absolutely. I did that for 15 years.
Yeah.
And I have a very... the more you run, the worse... not even the worse it gets, the more you realise you can't stop now because you've been running for so long. And when you stop, how are you going to address this? And is there any way of addressing this? And I remember stopping, and I had no choice, because it was due to a conversation when someone said, I think you're putting more energy into hiding this than dealing with it. And that made a huge impact on me, because I was putting so much energy into hiding it. And I had to start telling people. I had to get that off my chest first before I started looking at how I can deal with this. And ultimately, it was a combination of peer support,
yeah,
really good therapy, and really good mindfulness training, and a really good GP. And combining all that together, I was very lucky that I was in a position where I had access to all these things. But there's an awful lot of people in this country who don't have that access and that support. And that's why I'm very passionate about trying to make this available, or make this type of information available, because I know how powerful it is and I know how helpful it can be. So how we do that, I don't know.
Right. Listening to something on the radio, it was one of the Cusack brothers, wasn't it, on News Talk.
Mm.
You had to pull over by the side of the road because you felt you'd kind of got a slap in the face.
I was driving home to Mullingar. I was on the motorway, which you're not meant to pull in on, but Connor was speaking. And at the time, I kind of addressed it a little bit. I'd done some chats in schools, but it was his language, it was his framing of the language that just grabbed me. And I remember just trying to search for his name on Twitter, because I didn't know him, and found it, and I connected with him, and I just sent him this message about it. And I remember he said something that really changed what I was doing as well. I was getting very overwhelmed, because I was going into schools and I was speaking, and I was when people were coming up saying that, you know, that it was helpful or whatever, I was getting overwhelmed by that. And Connor said, think of the one person you help in that room. Don't try and think of the bigger thing, because it will overwhelm you. Think of the one person who's now leaving that room, who's going home and saying something to their mother or father. and go with that. And that was really helpful and useful at the time.
Right. Well, it's part of radio thinking, isn't it? Mm. That it's one listener at a time. How do you think we go... Oh, no, wait, before it. Tell me about the children's book.
The children's book was... When I was doing my master's, I got very interested in the research around children and children's emotions and what they're dealing with and how their brains work and how their brains don't work and how they're developing. And I found that that area was very interesting to me. So I always had this keen interest on bringing kind of mindfulness approaches to young kids, because two things with kids is they, you know, trying to tell a hyper child to calm down is the most pointless thing you can do. And I've seen parents try to, you know, parents going like, what do we do in these situations? And I always thought with mindfulness, I always felt a physical cue is a really helpful use. Kids love having kind of some kind of cue. So I started reading about this, and I have a 6-year-old nephew, Billy, who I really based the whole thing on. And I used to see just the normal little emotions that he would deal with, like jealousy, like anger, like fear. These are all things kids like have to navigate. And I wanted to write books that kind of dealt with an emotion, each emotion at a certain time. The first emotion was fear. In the first book, The Magic Moment, what does he do when you get frightened? And the second book that's coming out in October is around jealousy and rejection, and how to deal with that as a young kid. And parents would say, oh God, you shouldn't be talking about that stuff. You should be. Kids can absolutely deal with that. If you're not going to get into heavy stuff about mental health with a child. Of course you're not. But you're able to talk to them, and it gives them a vehicle to talk to their parents about the simple fears that they may have, whether it's going to a swimming pool, whether it's somebody getting a present that they wanted and they get jealous, whether someone takes an iPad off them and they have an absolute meltdown. These are all things parents are dealing with. So I basically developed these mindfulness techniques that can be used to help kids in those moments, and told a story with Freddie and his nana. And his nana is the kind of the messenger, like my mother is with Billy. So it's kind of that connection.
Yeah, that always seems to work. Well, when it works brilliantly, that grandparent-child
relationship. My granny Mac, we used to call her, was fundamentally, I remember nearly every moment I had with her. She was a huge impact on my childhood.
Funny, isn't it? Now, in broader terms, you're not overly impressed with the way we deal with mental health here.
No, and I mean, it's very...
Our mental illness here.
I mean, let's call a spade here. We can do two things here. We can get really... And we should be, you know, as citizens of this country, we need to be aware of how it's working and how it's not working and where it's working and where it isn't working. But one of the things with A Lust for Life, which we set up our charity, was we didn't want to be stone throwers. We didn't want to be... We wanted to bring potential solution-based approaches to how our systems are working around mental health. And the reality is... You know, I'm not mad about statistics because I sometimes think they dehumanise the reality of the story. But we spend 6% of our entire health budget on mental health. And you look at all the major social issues we have in Ireland. A lot of these social issues have mental health at the very foundation. People who haven't been able to cope with whatever it is, whether it is losing their job, losing a loved one, homelessness, all these things. And we have to start looking far more strategically at mental health and how we do it. And we've looked at things like Vision for Change, which was an amazing policy, phenomenal policy written 10 years around mental health ago. But we didn't implement it.
Right.
And we're brilliant policy writers. And this isn't about politics, Marion. We have to get the politics
out
of this.
Would you consider it?
No, I'd rather eat my shoes. Never. Because I have no problem with politics or politicians, and I know many good people who went into politics who couldn't get a lot done, especially in this area, because it's too layered, it's too bureaucratic. And we have to be brave. We have to be really brave here and figure out what to do. But there's some real basic things that you can look at. Things like 24-hour mental health services, for starters. You know, not 9 to 5. You look at down in Limerick where some of the job people do, these are the real stories we hear every day down in Limerick, and they basically walk around the river stopping people jumping off bridges, and they have to bring them into hospital, and half the time these people just walk straight back out again because there's no way to hold them, to help them, to support them.
Well, I mean, I've heard many people, I mean, the emergency departments are open through the night, but I've heard people who are very, very ill saying that for them to go in to an A&E, particularly under the current circumstances, that it's like walking into chaos and it melts their heads.
Never, ever, ever should we allow somebody at that level of distress walk into A&E. A&E is not
the
place.
Then where do you go?
that's the point. And that's what we have to create. There's been movement now in 24-hour crisis centres. I remember in London, in my own situation, I found myself in a very similar situation like that, where I didn't feel, I had been drinking, and I'm not a big drinker, and I'd been taking sleeping pills, and between the combination, I felt very, very overwhelmed. And I went into one of these crisis centres, and I was very well looked after and very well cared for, and it was held. And that's really important when you're at that level of the stress. And but also the point being, even if you're not, we need to create better services and systems. And also there's much more complex things like dual diagnosis in Ireland around addiction and mental health services, whether you can be treated at the same time, even though they're intrinsically linked. You know, there's real basic stuff here that we can address. And even breaking down the systems, like the preventative models, like within the education system, we also have to understand this is not our teachers' jobs. They have enough to do. They have a lot on their shoulders.
They sure do.
And we can't just be going, we have to put mental health in schools. If we're going to do it, fund it, resource it, do it properly, and be serious about it.
Right. Couple of callers. Niall speaks words of wisdom. Buddhist philosophy taught through mindfulness is the answer to well-being. We also need to manage technology and protect our children. Building empathy and acceptance of ourselves and others is essential for a happy society. Now, there are an awful lot of things in that remark. I mean, managing technology to protect kids is a very big one. Buddhist philosophy taught through mindfulness. Now, you mentioned a couple of times your podcast, which goes live on Monday. And really what you're trying to do here is explain what you're trying to do here. And I heard the fourth one yesterday. Stephen Fry was on it, and a survivor of the Holocaust. And it's just so hard to figure out what the point of it is. I mean, we heard his story, a wonderful man. I've met him before and interviewed him. His name is Tommy Reichenthal. Mm-hmm. He was 9, Holocaust victim, and how later on he started telling his story and the bits that got to him. Mm. I mean, hello, excuse me, the Holocaust is bits, it's not about bits. But one where he and other children of his age were humiliated and treated like puppy dogs, like animals, basically. And you think that's something you take over and over and over again. The rest of us might say, bad things happen, leave it there, move on.
So if we go back to that text, there's Buddhist psychology.
Yes, yes.
And you break down, like, now, let's be clear, I'm not a Buddhist, but there's a hell of a lot within the Buddhist psychologies that I cannot describe how impactful they were to me. And if you look at the noble truths of Buddhism, the first noble truth of Buddhism is that suffering is an inevitable part of being a human being. That's the first noble truth.
Suffering is inevitable.
And if you, that sounds quite depressing in itself, but when you think about it, every one of us experiences grief, financial issues, relationship issues, stress, pain, health issues. Every single one on this earth at some stage in your life will deal with that. So that's a very valid point. The second noble truth is, what causes that suffering? Where's that suffering coming from? And what the Buddha suggested was, comes from attachment to having everything a certain way all the time, and aversion to not feeling certain things. And when you think about that and break that down, if suffering is inevitable, we tend to run from it. And now, I'm not saying you have to high five it and hug it and you know, embrace it every time it happens. But when you run from it, it can cause huge psychological problems. And this is the thing, you talk to psychologists. It's teaching people, if you break it down then to say it's psychotherapy, which the first two waves of psychotherapy were Freud, and then second was CBT, and they were like, let's get rid of the pain, or let's kind of put it somewhere else. The third wave, which is where mindfulness is, and acceptance and commitment therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, says, no, you can't get rid of it, but you can change your relationship with it. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to disempower the thing that's taking over your life, that's powering you all the time. So whether it's post-traumatic stress, something happened in your life that was very traumatic, you can put it somewhere and pretend it hasn't happened, but your brain knows it has. Your psychology has been influenced by it. All these things have been influenced. And we sometimes think we're dealing with things because we're obsessively working, or we're obsessively exercising, or we're doing something, but we're not really. We're hiding it, or we're running from it. Now, let's be clear, it is very, very difficult sometimes to deal with this stuff. And a good mindfulness teacher needs to know, where do we go here? And how far do we go? And when is it a point where this person needs some extra help and needs some proper therapeutic support and psychological intervention? So this is the reality of how we treat this stuff, because running doesn't work. And then there's somebody who's experienced quite acute trauma who needs a lot of help and a lot of support. That my fear with this is, and with mindfulness, is I know an awful lot of that extra support isn't there. And that scares me.
Right.
And that scares me a lot with the people I work with. So I have to be very, very, very careful when I work with people to make sure that I don't bring them to a place that's too exposing for them. But also, if it is, that there's absolutely 100% support there for them by a professional who knows exactly what to do. And in an ideal, romantic, perfect world, we would have systems that do that. And we'd be able to deal with these traumas in a much better way. And it's very important to point out as well, you don't have to have experienced a difficult past or a difficult trauma to struggle with your mind. It's a silly way to look at it.
Yeah.
Our minds are not infinite sources. They can be affected. And everyone's stress and pain is subjective to them.
Right.
Something that you might find very painful, I wouldn't, and vice versa. So we have to be much more open-minded with pain.
Right. You tell the story of a man that you admire very much in a hospital in the United States where recovery rates weren't good for one cohort, and he asked if he could work with them.
With
the patients in
hospital. So the godfather of Western mindfulness is a guy called Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn. And Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn was a molecular biologist, which is exactly what you expect a yogi, a meditator to be. And Jon Kabat-Zinn is the man essentially who brought, in all intents and purposes, brought mindfulness to the Western world in 1979. But he was a consultant in this hospital, and an awful lot of his consultant doctors were getting nowhere with some of his patients. And he said to his colleagues, can I treat them?
Yeah.
Can I work with them for a period of time? And he did, and he developed this course called the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Course, which is an 8-week course, which is a very heavily peer-reviewed, evidence-based course. And over time, he started changing their relationship with pain, physical and emotional. People with arthritis, people with other pains, and people who had had injuries, and people who had emotional injuries and issues. And he worked with them, and that course, the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction course, is essentially what the podcast is based on in terms of the evidence-based.
Okay.
I've done it many times, and I teach that course.
Right. I just want to skip back because I forgot to ask you the technique with the kids, the magic moment trick.
Yeah. It's funny because kids run up to me now in cafes. I'd be having a coffee with the mum, and they just do this trick in front of me, and they'd be staring there, and I'd be having a coffee, and they're just looking at me, and I'm like, either they're really scared of me, or they're just showing me the trick.
Yeah.
But basically, it's based around fear, and Freddie in the book has a fear. He was really excited about going to the swimming pool, and he couldn't wait to get there for his first swimming pool. And he got there, and there was loads of big boys there, and they were all shouting, and he got a bit overwhelmed and scared. And he told his dad, "I just want to go home now. I don't want to go in." And he didn't know what this feeling was, so he went home anyway. And his granny came in that night and said, "What's wrong with you?" He goes, "I was too scared to get into the pool." So his granny gave him this little technique, and it's basically where you get your thumb and your forefinger and both hands, and you squeeze them together really tight, and you close your eyes, and you take 10 really deep breaths and think of something that made you really happy, like Christmas Day, or in Freddie's cases when his dog Larry came to the house for the first time and he fell in love with the dog and played with the dog, and he just thought about that memory, and he squeezed his fingers and took 10 deep breaths. And then his granny said, "Now every time you get a little bit scared, just get your fingers like that and squeeze them together and think of that memory. And that's your magic moment." And he started doing it, and kids all over Ireland are doing it. It's amazing. Yeah. But one kid did say to me down in, I was down at the Listowel Writers' Week, and I did the whole thing, and the kids were all doing it in the class. And he just turned around and went, "That's not magic." And I'm like, okay. I bent the magic word a little bit. But
right, so. Okay. Marion, I first encountered Niall in The Voice some years ago, and he had a positive impact on me then. He's doing the same thing again for me now, listening to him. I'm living with MS and facing into a cancer diagnosis, but listening to Niall is giving me real hope and real positivity. And that comes from Dara in Cork.
Thank you very much, Dara.
Isn't that? That's worth a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it can be overwhelming as well, because I think the word that stood out as well is real positivity. There's, you know, real positivity. I think real positivity for me is knowing what makes me happy, and that's knowing people I love are happy. That's a huge thing for
me.
So
okay.
Kind of putting your attention on those things and not on the things that you don't have and the things that we're told we need to have all the time, because that takes its toll on your head, your body, and those around you.
Is this for everyone?
It's very important that I'm very protective of mindfulness. I'm very, very protective that it's been diluted quite a lot because what we do with things that can be really helpful is we often commodify them and we try to package them and market them in a way that are more digestible. This is hard. 8 week mindfulness course is not easy. You go places that can be tough. Headspace, those apps, they're great. They're great. They're kind of concentration apps. They're concentration meditation, whatever. But there's many more layers to meditation and mindfulness. And mindfulness is not about meditation. It's about a way of being. And it's about becoming more present and putting your attention on the really good things that are happening right now, right in front of your face. But you're so busy trying to get somewhere that you're missing them.
Okay. Okay. And it starts on Monday. And it's free.
Absolutely. And there's a 6 week mindfulness course with it where I'll be doing guided meditations with the audience today. It's an extra podcast. So if anyone wants to get into meditation, it's a good way to do it.
Okay, listen, thank you very, very much indeed. And I hope that's of benefit to an awful lot of people. Okay, and we'll take a break.